Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, November 3rd. I'm Ray Graff. The heart of powerful Hurricane Eta has begun moving ashore in Nicaragua. It is a Category 4 hurricane, winds of 140 miles per hour. It has destroyed rooftops, caused rivers to overflow. It's a slow-moving storm. Today, we welcome back meteorologist Jason Goff to talk about that and any other weather questions you might have. Jason runs a great weather website, jasonsweather.com. If you have a question, give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Always great to have Jason Goff on the program. He is here to answer your weather questions right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today on the line, we're joined by meteorologist Jason Goff, who is here to answer your weather questions. Jason runs a weather forecasting website, jasonsweather.com. He has been a TV weatherman for a long time. He has been on these airwaves giving forecasts. He knows what he's talking about. Always a great guest on this program. If you have a question about the weather, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. We'll do that as well, but the number is 800-348-2551. Jason Goff, once again, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good, Ray. Thanks for the kind words, man. I'm going to pop a check in the mail before this afternoon is out.
Hey, we can't do that.
How you doing today?
It's public radio. I'm doing pretty good. I'm doing very good. You know, I mentioned at the top of the show Hurricane Eta, and I'll get to that for a minute. But I just thought of this as we were going into the rejoin here after the news. You know, many parts of our region saw the first measurable snow of the year, or at least the first significant amount, even if it was a half an inch or whatever. How much snow did they get in the so-called lake effect regions the other day?
In the lake effect regions, not a whole lot. They actually got more last night and into this morning. So the totals that have been coming in basically since Sunday night, so about the last 48 hours or so, they did real well up in the Adirondacks places. I'm just looking at the latest, what's called a
I think we lost Jason there for a minute. We'll try to get him back on the line. I'll read you this news copy on Hurricane Eta while we're waiting for Jason to get back, and then we'll talk about the snow again. The heart of powerful Hurricane Eta began moving ashore in Nicaragua this morning, with devastating winds and rains already having destroyed rooftops and caused rivers to overflow. The hurricane had sustained winds of 140 miles per hour, according to the U.S. National Hurricane Center, and that was down from an overnight peak of 150 miles per hour. While the eye wall of this Category 4 hurricane had hit shore, its center was about 20 miles south-southeast of shore. It was moving west near 3 miles per hour. And landfall came hours after it had been expected. Eta just hung around for hours, overnight into the morning, just didn't move. Okay, and Jason and I have talked about that phenomenon where the hurricane just sits there and grinds. And Jason, this was one of those cases.
Yeah, I just got back onto the call, Ray. Sorry about that.
I'm not sure what happened,
but here we are.
We'll talk about snow in a minute.
Yeah, so as far as Eta is concerned, that's just a crisis down there in Nicaragua. I mean, you're talking about, as of the latest advisory, 140 mile an hour winds. It is barely moving to the west, and it is going to basically rake across Central America. And then the forecast actually has it taking like a really hard right and coming back into the Caribbean. On early Saturday. So that's going to be interesting to see as it is forecast to become a tropical storm again as it heads toward Cuba, but we'll see where it goes from there. But this thing, unfortunately, is not done, but it is going to be a nasty thing to deal with down there in Central America because it gets real mountainous in a hurry, so you get a lot of flooding. You get mudslides and all kinds of things, and you have a lot of people that are in a lot of trouble.
You know, you and I have talked about some of these storms that just sort of hang. What is the longest lived hurricane? How long has one stayed more or less at hurricane strength?
I'd have to go back and look at that. There was one, the one that comes to mind, and I can't remember the name of it, but it was out, it stayed out in the Atlantic. So it was good because it didn't really menace anybody. It was out there. I think it was like 28 days that it had at least kept tropical storm status. So I'd have to look that up, but they do have records for those kinds of things. Of course, the storm that nobody will forget is, was Dorian from last year. That storm, you want to talk about, I mean, you can talk about a storm staying out over the Atlantic for 28 days. That's all good and well. But the most consequential storm, at least in my memory in paying attention to these things, was Dorian, that literally sat over the Bahamas, specifically over a place where I used to fish. And it just completely raked the landscape clean. It was, in essence, it was an F3 tornado that lasted not, you know, 15 minutes, but more like 24 to 48 hours. It was unbelievable.
That's a colossal amount of energy just to feed that storm and keep it going.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, and the storm just continued, and that's how those things survive. You know, they really sort of feed on themselves. You know, when you get into the Bahamian chain, you have all these islands, 700 plus islands, and the water there, at least in spots, is not very deep. And so you want to have nice warm water to keep those things going. And that storm just continued to just pummel. It barely, I mean, it didn't move for an entire day, and it just kept sweeping that place clean. It was just unfathomable. As hurricanes go, it has to be one of the most destructive in history.
Meteorologist Jason Goff joins us today. The number is 800-348-2551 if you want to join the conversation. 800-348-2551. A couple things. One, refresh my memory as to the dynamics involved with a storm that stays in one spot like this one, or as opposed to, say, the Long Island Express from whenever, the 30s or what, that just blew through Long Island at 70 miles an hour. What makes them different? Why does one stay put and one move so fast?
It has to do with what they call steering currents, and that can be a trough of low pressure that's coming through, and a hurricane like the Long Island Express can come up along that, and it'll, in essence, think of like a conveyor belt, right? Like the thing gets hooked in with the teeth and everything, and it just shoots it right up. So that's what can happen there. On the other side of the spectrum, you could have a storm where there's really nothing to steer it around. Typically in the summertime, when you're talking about hurricanes and where they're going to be steering, or as they're called, recurving out to sea, they'll get hooked around the western periphery of an area of high pressure, and that will kind of steer it. And so the trick is, in forecasting, I say that lightly, it's much more than a trick.
Right.
The challenge for the men and women, you know, who forecast these things at the Hurricane Center is to try to figure out, because sometimes these storms will be like an elusive running back, right? Like they'll go in between an area of high pressure and an upper level trough somewhere else. And that would, you know, and how that storm interacts with these other larger systems will ultimately determine where it goes in the short term and in the long term.
One of the things that struck me in reading this rather long piece on Hurricane Eta is that in the space of 24 hours, this thing tripled in strength. In other words, we had 40-mile-an-hour winds on Sunday morning, 120-mile-an-hour winds by midday yesterday, and today we're at 140. Is there an equation that you guys use that says, okay, well, this is going to progress really fast?
Well, you get these what's called a rapid intensification, and that's in essence what happens is these things really blow up. Sometimes they can be forecast, and sometimes they can't. And you know, there's still a lot of work to be done in hurricane research and everything. I mean, they're you know, constantly the hurricane hunters are flying in and out of these storms, and they finally flew into Eta yesterday because you know they make satellite estimates as to the strength of these storms, which you really need actual instrumental truth and that is when that, these planes fly in and out of these things, and they're dropping the radio sounds and getting all these measurements at various levels. So not only are they getting, are they gathering the data for the storms themselves, but they're also using that for future forecasting purposes. So as far as having a storm like that that blows up, all the conditions have to be right. You have to have very light wind aloft. You've got to have a good, healthy storm that's got good inflow and outflow, so the storm is actually breathing in a sense. And, of course, it's got plenty of warm water, you know, well over 80 degrees down to depths of, you know, 75 feet. So that's all the fuel you need, and that's basically what happens. And these storms can just – they just kind of click into that right spot, and they just blow up.
Meteorologist Jason Goff joins us today. Jason's website is jasonsweather.com. We're ready to take your calls at 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll be right back. Fox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. Weather today with meteorologist Jason Goff. Jason's website is jasonsweather.com. And let's go to the phones. Joan in Schenectady. Hello, Joan.
Hello, gentlemen.
Hi.
Hey, Joan.
Hey, how are you today?
I'm good, thank you.
Good. I wanted to talk about that horrible storm at the beginning of October. It was amazing that in 4 minutes, the north side of three mature maples were stripped. And it was totally like physics, like the irresistible force and the immovable objects. Yeah. They had such a full canopy. I don't think they were willing to let go of the wind. It only lasted 4 minutes, and it was terrifying. But
it really was.
Whoa, what winds.
Yeah,
it was really something else. I mean, not only did you have the winds coming from that cluster of storms, but the forward speed of those storms was running at about 70 miles an hour. So, yeah, you have fully leaved trees. That is a, you know, you're talking about lots and lots of surface area to catch that wind. And you know, if that wind is blowing just in the right orientation, the strongest trees or at least the strongest limbs are not going to be able to handle that.
Right. They were just ripped, and not the dead wood that is still up there. Just like the healthiest part of the heartwood.
Yeah. Did you lose power, Joan?
Yeah, that's very
48 hours, Ray. Thanks very much for asking.
Well, we lost it longer than that. I'm with you there. It was not fun. A fridge full of food went bad.
I understand. I share that sorrow. And I'm so glad I had all my camping gear still out. I just pretty much made sure everybody could charge their phones off of this little fire pot I had. And then had a little teeny tiny socially responsible mini party while we were without power.
Well, I'm glad you survived.
There you go. Good
even
for
if
you.
Even if the maple didn't. Joan, thanks a lot. Jason Goff is our guest. Tying in with that call, Jason, before we get back to the phones, this email from Paula in Beacon. Paula says, what role does the weather play on the coloring of the leaves during the fall? The Hudson Valley looks incredible. Is it because of the amount of rain we received during spring and summer? And that is from Paula in Beacon.
Yes, that's a really good question. It was a fabulous year of foliage. You generally need to have, you know, good, healthy trees, which means they had to have gotten the right amount of water, not too much, not too little. And that's in essence what we had. I mean, certainly we had some dry stretches, especially as you headed deeper into New England. We had, you know, quite a bit of dry weather as we got to the latter part of the summer. But by then, you know, those leaves are going to start to think about turning, especially in the higher elevation. So everything lined up great. We had the warmer days, the cooler nights right in the middle of the month. Things really kind of took off. So it was a well-designed foliage year in an otherwise not so great year. At least we had good foliage, we can say.
Well, that's one plus. You're always looking at the bright side. Meteorologist Jason Goff is our guest. 800-348-2551. If you have a weather question for Jason, you can also email us at VoxPop at WAMC.org. Let's go to Chris in Housatonic. Chris, you're up.
Yeah, Ray and Jason. I have a couple of questions. Number one, sometimes in the course of this winter and the summer, I would notice a rainbow around the sun. And then my second question is, this wouldn't be a rainbow, but I would notice these sometimes cirrus clouds and stratus clouds have like a rainbow color in the cloud. Yep. And then my last question for you, Jason, is, you know, sometimes, you know, all the time we see like white lightning and stuff like this. Has lightning been known to have colored lightning?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's and basically what you're looking at there is the difference in the temperature of, you know, obviously lightning is very, very hot. So it just really depends. I will never forget. I went through what at one time was Hurricane Opal when I lived in Auburn. And yeah, it came just to our west as a strong tropical storm and, you know, did quite a bit of damage. Actually, not as much as the most recent storm there that came through. But it was, I remember there wasn't a lot of lightning with it, but the lightning was blue. I mean, I can remember it like it was yesterday. It was really something else. Just it has to do with the relative temperatures. So the hotter it is, the whiter it is going to be. So you could have lightning that's kind of yellowish, orangish, bluish, and so it has to do with that. And so you're dealing with, you know, obviously with a really damp environment, to say the least, when you're in the middle of a tropical storm. And so the weather, the air, and everything around it is going to be a little bit cooler, but it's still not something to mess around with. Now, getting back to your other question about what you're seeing, there are a couple of different things that you're seeing in the cirrus clouds. And think of them like as a reverse rainbow. Like you have to see a rainbow, the sun is behind you, and then you can see the rainbow. We'll see those every year. And then you also, especially as we're getting now into this time of year and through the spring, you'll see what are called sun dogs. And it's the same idea as a rainbow, only the cloud is between you and the sun. And so you're seeing that in there, and you have these ice crystals, and they are separating out the light, right? You remember your Roy G. Biv, so they're separating that out just like a raindrop does. This ice crystal is doing the same, and so that's what you're seeing. And then on occasion, you can see something that's called a circumzenithal arc. Huh? And that is, it is a mouthful. And that kind of looks like an upside down rainbow. Those are a little bit more rare, but a lot of times you can see on a day from here on through the spring, you can look up into some cirrus clouds if it's kind of got some faded sun. And if you hit the angle just right, you'll see some sun dogs in there, and they're kind of cool looking. Not nearly as spectacular as, you know, as a rainbow after a storm comes through. But still, they're kind of cool to see just the same.
Chris, thank you very much for the call. Jason Goff is our guest. The number is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Casey in Rexford. Casey, you're on.
Hi, Jay. Hi, Ray.
Hi.
I have a question about the hurricane in Nicaragua. How unusual is it for a hurricane in the Pacific to reach Central America and then cross, just to reach Central America to begin with on the Pacific side, and then to cross over? And, you know, remember on the Atlantic side where the Caribbean is, you have all of these countries that are already having devastating agricultural effects from climate change and seawater coming into crops. So what kind of damage are lower-lying islands in the Caribbean looking at from this hurricane? And then my first question again, which is about the occurrence of hurricanes coming in, making from the west all the way to Central America.
Okay.
Well, I'll answer that in a couple of different ways. First of all, this storm actually came from the east. Ada did. It was born a little bit farther south in the Caribbean, but it's more common to have hurricanes cross from the Pacific into like Mexico, and they'll go up. You'll see them go into the desert southwest sometimes. But
right. So that's what made me think that Central America is a little unusual.
Well, look, you can get hurricanes pretty much anywhere north of about 8-9 degrees latitude. So, and this is the time of year. There was a hideous hurricane that hit. I think it was 98, and Mitch was the name of that storm, and that was just brutal. And it followed a similar track where it just basically made a beeline to Central America and just killed tens of thousands of people. For those reasons that you mentioned, you do have a lot of deforestation. And not only that, with the mountainous regions there, rather quickly as you get inland from the coast, that rain, that's going to only enhance the rainfall. So that's a big problem there. Now, the storm, as we mentioned, is forecast to basically make landfall. It has made landfall in Nicaragua, kind of then take a little bit of an arc up through Central America, and then take a hard right and head back into the Caribbean and make its way toward Cuba next week. So we're not done with this storm yet.
Thank you, Casey, for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. You said hurricanes can occur anywhere higher, north of 8 or 9 degrees. Why not at the equator?
There's no spin. And I mean, the general rule is 10 degrees, but you can get one that'll sneak down. There are a few that can manage there. But when you get down to like the South American coast, you know, where you have the ABC there, you have Bonaire and Curacao and Aruba, and off of the coast, like a Venezuela up that way, that's about as far south as you can go, just because you don't have the rotation of the earth to get these things spinning. And that's what you need to start really to get a hurricane going. You've got to get some storms that start rotating around each other.
Fascinating. Jason Goff is our guest. It's weather today on the program. 800-348-2551 is our number. If you have a question for Jason, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Al is in Newburgh. Al, you're on.
Hey, Ray and Jay, thanks for taking my call. How are you?
Good. How you doing?
Good, thank you.
Yeah. Nice. I'm always curious, parse what I'm saying or asking, and if it's not interesting, be brief or whatever, but I'm curious about what influences, controls, or is affected by high and low pressure systems. And besides, say, a barometer, what indications do we have on Earth as casual observers as to when a high or a low pressure system is extreme or changing?
Oh, that's good. Yeah, I mean, it's always nice to have some kind of a barometer. You know, there's all kinds of different ones out there. They have the little water ones, and then, of course, you can have different types with numbers and dials and things on them. But generally speaking, when you know that there's going to be a pressure change, and this is a perfect example, right? We had all that wind yesterday through a good chunk of this morning, and now I'm looking out the window, and there's really not – I mean, the trees are moving a little bit, but the wind has definitely come down. And so we are long in the wake of that trough of low pressure that came in, and we've got some high pressure that's going to be coming in here later on, which is going to do a couple of things. First of all, it's going to bring us a cold night tonight, but then it's going to bring us some really nice weather as we get into the middle, especially the end of the week and into the weekend, and even into early next week. We're going to look at a nice little string of 60s. So that is, you know, those are your pressure differences in that sense. So when the wind is blowing, a lot of times that is your transition time in between a high and low, or a low and a high that's coming through. So, you know, this time of year when we get these lake effects, you know, snows going, that's because generally a big trough or cold front came on through. And then we've got a lot of wind coming behind it to kind of fill in that hole in the atmosphere, if you will. So that's a good way to tell, for starters, you know, when we've got some changes that are going to be coming about for better or worse.
Yeah, I made a barometer with a Cairo corn syrup once with a kit I got from Sears in high school. And I had a anemometer and a dry bulb thermometer and all that. But what causes a high pressure or a low pressure system to form?
So you have, in essence, think about high pressure is sinking air and low pressure is rising air. So, and then the difference in between the two, like Nate, basically the earth, you always hear that adage, you know, nature abhors a vacuum. If the earth had its way, everything would be the same across the board. The weather would be the same. It wouldn't change. It would be really cold at the poles, really hot at the equator. And, you know, basically that would be what the earth would want to do, is just to kind of keep everything in check. But it doesn't do that. So it tries to compensate. So that's what brings us, you know, the Gulf Stream and the California Current, as far as the water currents that go up and down either side of the United States. And so to that end, when you have an area of low pressure, like a hurricane is an extreme example of that. It's a storm that forms. You have a lot of air that is rising from the surface up into the atmosphere. So in order to combat that, as the planet, in the planet's rule book, it says, hey, I've got to fill this in. And so in an effort to do that, you've got air that's coming in from an area of higher pressure that's going to be filling in that air at the surface. Or it happens aloft too, but at the surface, we'll just say, to be able to replace that air that's rising. And the faster the air is rising and the more air that's rising, the stronger those winds are going to be to come in to replace it. And that's in essence how you're dealing with these areas, you know. And sometimes, you know, you can get an area of low pressure that'll come through here and you won't even know it because it's so weak. There's not a whole lot going on. And you know, there might be a little bit of a breeze and that's it. But then again, on the other side, you've got big storms and hurricanes and things that are quite the opposite.
Thank you very much for the call, Al. Jason Goff is our guest today. It's weather, 800-348-2551. If you have a question for Jason, what's the lowest recorded pressure, atmospheric pressure at sea level that you know of?
As far as tropical weather goes, I'd have to look that up as well. It was either Allen in 1980 or Gilbert in 1988. One of those storms. Allen hit Texas, and I think Gilbert hit the central Gulf Coast. But both were very strong storms, and they had really low pressure. And now that I think of it, now maybe Wilma in 2005, yeah, which is the second most active. Actually, it's tied with this year for being the most active hurricane seasons, and I think Wilma might have eclipsed that, or it's pretty close. So I'd have to look that up, Ray. But okay, generally, when you're talking about low pressure, you're talking about hurricanes. If we could somehow get a barometer inside of a tornado or at the ground where a tornado passes over, you would find that pressure, you know, to be very, very low as well. But obviously, that's just about an impossibility. It's a, you'd have to throw a dart and just get lucky for that to happen. But for hurricanes, we get a good sense of how low those things can go, and they're down in, you know, in the nine teens range. It's just really, really low pressure.
You know, I learn a lot on this program, and in your last answer, you said something that I really didn't ever even thought about. So when it's low pressure, the air is essentially going up. So you have a lot of updraft at that point?
Yes. In essence, that's what's going on. You've got air that's moving up. And so you have, so, I mean, you know, if you're at, like, you go to the beach in Maine every summer, Ray. So yeah, when you have these sea breezes that come in, and you, especially you get these in Florida, which is the reason, by the way, you get thunderstorms in Florida every day, but that's kind of a different topic. So you get these sea breezes, right? So you have water that heats at a different rate than the sand does. So the sand heats faster. So that air is going to rise. So then you're going to have air that's coming in from the relatively cooler waters of the Atlantic or the Gulf to replace that rising air. Then at night, the sand cools off a lot faster than the water does. So then you're at night, you're going to have an offshore wind because the wind is going to be replacing from the cooler sand out over the water where that water is warmer. So the air over it is warmer and thus rising.
You know, you've taught me so many things I can go home and completely mangle when I talk to my kids. I get it all wrong every time. But Jason, he's on the case. We'll get to more of your calls in a moment. 800-348-2551. If you want to talk weather with the man, he'll be back. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. You can email us as well at voxpop@wamc.org. Meteorologist Jason Goff joins us today. And hang in there. If you're on the line, we'll get to your calls shortly. Mary in Albany, you'll be next. So patience, Mary. This email came in, Jason, from Mark. And Mark says, please explain, what's the difference between a nor'easter and a hurricane, and what are the different dangers of each? Which one is more of a threat for our area?
Well, it depends on what you're talking about. And I was just looking up, Ray, I was right that it was Wilma, not the lowest pressure ever recorded, but the lowest of a hurricane was 882 millibars of pressure. And just to give you a point of reference, ours right now is sitting at about 1020. So might be difficult to contextualize, but anyway, it's much better to be not be dealing with a 1020 high as opposed to an 882 low. So back to Mark's question about hurricanes. So it's interesting because in a vacuum, hurricanes are going to be nastier for this area. But that said, you know, nor'easters, because they come in the wintertime and because they're relatively frequent here in any given year, you know, we can have 4, 6, 8 of these things, you know, somewhere impacting the East Coast. They do a lot more coastal erosion than you'll notice with, you know, than a hurricane over a 10 or 20 year stretch. You can have obviously a hurricane that would come in and reshape a lot of stuff, but we will go years and years without having to deal with a hurricane in the Northeast, whereas a nor'easter is going to come at, you know, pretty much any winter. So, and then how they're different is there's one big difference. Hurricanes are known as warm core systems. So you've heard like when the debacle with Sandy, when it was a hurricane and then it became extra tropical.
Yep.
And these are semantics with the government meteorologist, which is fine. But your goal as a meteorologist, especially in that capacity, is to relay the information to the public in a way that they can understand it. And they did a horrible job of doing that and admitted it later, which was good, and have made changes since. So what happens is these hurricanes, as we mentioned, they're born of warm water. You've got to have warm water to get these things going. That's one of the key ingredients. Whereas a nor'easter, that is sparked by, I mean, it can take off because of warm water if you get an area of low pressure that develops quickly off the coast. But those are coming generally from either an upper level storm or even a cold front can kind of stall off the coast. And that can help to incite an area of low pressure to get going. And if it gets strong enough, if all the conditions are right, then you have your nor'easter. But the difference is that you think about hurricanes, they are truly tropical systems, whereas nor'easters are cold systems. And that is both figurative and literal.
All right, this one came in from James in Kingston. And this is a great question, too. James writes, I know that hurricanes draw their prodigious moisture from the evaporation of warm ocean water. And what happens to the salt when the water vapor condenses and falls back down as rain? That's from James in Kingston.
That's a great question. And the short answer is that the water evaporates from the salt. Now, you do have salt that is dissolved in water. So you are going to have a saline content of rain right along the coast, but it's not going to be like raining seawater on you. So that's in essence what happens is the water itself, because you think about if you had a cup of seawater, right, you have different minerals in there, and then obviously you have the good old H2O, and it is that water that is going to evaporate the salt that's in it and the other minerals that are there, not so much, but you will have a little bit of a residual thing in there, but it's not like you would have to worry necessarily about raining salt water on your crops or whatever. But that is a good question. Yes.
All right. To the phones we go. 800-348-2551 is our number. Jason Goff is our guest, and let's go to Mary in Albany. Mary.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question. Actually, you sort of were talking about it earlier regarding the equator, Aruba a few years ago, and I remember the first day at the beach, it didn't seem like there was a tide. And is that because it's so close to the equator?
I'm having a real hard time.
Okay, I think I got it. Yeah, your connection's bad, Mary, but I believe what Mary said, Jason. Well, you want to try it again? That sounds better.
Can you hear?
Yeah, okay. Go ahead.
Is that better?
Yep.
Okay. In Aruba, it didn't seem like there was a tide at the beach, like compared to Cape Cod, where the tide goes out like a mile. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Hello?
Yeah, we got you.
Oh, okay.
So there
you're making
not,
my engineer go a... crazy there. Sorry, Zach. I apologize. All right, you get the picture, right, Jason?
So she's asking about the difference in the tides between Aruba and, let's say, the Cape?
Right. Mary noticed much less of a tide when she was in Aruba.
Okay. That can have to do with a lot of different things. I mean, certainly when you're down there, you are closer to the equator, so you have less rotation, less sloshing around of the water, of course. But tides are also influenced by trade winds and winds, and you have generally lighter winds down toward the equator as well. So there's lots of different things going on there. Some places have tides that'll go way out, and not so much a function of latitude, but as you get a little bit closer to the equator, especially down there in Aruba, that is going to have a difference on it. And so the water is just not going to move as much.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Mary, thanks a lot for the
You're
call.
Welcome.
And ironically, her sound was perfect at the very end. So there you go. Sorry, Zach. I apologize on Mary's behalf. Layla in Mount Tremper. Layla, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I live in the Eastern Catskills at about 1,800 feet. And this morning we had some frozen precipitation, which sort of raised the question in my mind that what's the difference between sleet and hail? I mean, I tend to associate one with the warmer months and one with the colder months, but I'm guessing they're formed a little bit differently. So I just wonder what you would have to say about that.
Layla, I love this because I've heard Jason answer this, and that's one of the things that I mangle every time my kids ask. So Jason, tell us both again.
Okay, so here's the real easy thing to do. Hail only happens with thunderstorms. Okay, so that's we'll get that out of the way first. And so that'll hopefully help to make the difference or the differentiation in your mind. But they are born of very different processes. Hail is basically a raindrop that's been going up and down like an elevator inside of a thunderstorm. And as it does so, it accumulates more and more water on it, which freezes as it goes higher up into the sky. And then the more it goes up and down, the more the rain gets onto it, freezes, and that process repeats. And that's why generally bigger thunderstorms, you have larger hail because it can sustain a hailstone that can be up to the size of a baseball or larger. And you can actually, with a special saw, cut these hailstones in half, and you can count the rings just like you can in a tree to determine how many times up and down in the cloud this thing went. So that's how hail goes.
What's the record?
Sleet.
What's the record for going up and down?
Oh, that I don't know.
Okay.
I have no idea.
Well,
but
put that on your website.
I will do that. The bigger it is, the more trips that it made. So you could relate that to size. And I think the biggest hailstone was found in Kansas. And there was actually now, again, I'm kind of going through my Cliff Clavin mind here. I think there was a record broken maybe about 10 years ago. Somewhere in the plains, and it was, I don't know, the size of a cantaloupe or something. It was just some enormous hail, hailstone that came down. I mean, but that's just, again, that's a function of the stronger storms that are out there. We don't generally see storms anywhere that nasty here. So you're going to have those huge, huge stones. Now, we can still get some big hailstones here, a good 3 inches or so. That's plenty big for anybody, and certainly those can do their own bit of damage.
Yep.
Now, sleet is essentially frozen rain. The term freezing rain is actually a misnomer because it actually is rain that when it hits the surface, it's still liquid, but the surface is frozen, so it freezes, and that's what gives you what's called freezing rain. Sleet is actually because you have a thick layer of cold air aloft, and you have rain initially that falls out of the cloud or through the cloud, and it freezes on the way down. So you have a frozen raindrop, essentially, is what sleet is. So hail is so you had it spot on. Hail is a warm weather thing. Sleet is a cold weather thing. Hail can be small sizes. You can get a sort of a hybrid, if you will, in the spring and in the fall. It's called grapple, which is sometimes known as soft hail, and it's sort of the combination of sleet and snow. And it looks like one of those, and actually has the same consistency. Remember those little dipping dots?
Sure.
That you would get, you know, yeah. That's kind of what it reminds me of, or like these little styrofoam peanuts. They look like that. They're perfectly round, and they melt really quickly in your, you know, in the palm of your hand or on your fingertips or whatever. But you can typically get that. We'll see that a lot in March. You know, we'll tend to get that where you've got a lot of cold air aloft, and you know, temperature at the ground might be 50 degrees, but aloft it's a heck of a lot colder. And so you're going to have sort of a combination of snow and sleet, and it's called soft hail or grapple.
Grapple is, I've never heard that. Layla, how about you?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I love these old sort of Saxon words for things that we don't, you know, use that often.
Yeah.
And Jason, you also clarified for me freezing rain. It never made sense to me. It's like, what do you mean freezing rain? If it's falling like water, it's not. I mean, well, you know, anyway, you explained it, so thank you.
Hey, Layla, thanks for the call. Jason Goff is our guest. The website is jasonsweather.com. Hayden and Rensselaer. Hayden, you're on.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thanks for the call.
You bet.
Just curious, where do I send my campaign contribution for Jason for president?
Oh, I think he's going to run in 4 years, right?
Yeah.
Well,
no,
he's running on the keep date. He's running on the Keep Daylight Saving Time ticket, so I'm all for it.
Thank you for bringing that up. You ask your question first, Hayden, and then we'll talk about Daylight Savings Time. Go ahead.
Seriously, I was just curious if it seems like it's been much, much windier this year. I don't know whether it's just me getting old and crotchety or if it really has been windier, if they keep records on that and if that's actually the case. And keep up the good work, gentlemen.
Hey, thanks a lot. Well,
thank you.
Is it windier now?
No, you know, I do get that question a lot. People will say that, oh, it's windier than I can remember. And Ray, you and I have talked about this 100 times about people's
perception,
kind of remembering things a little bit differently and whatever.
Yep.
But no, I mean, you know, we get wind. You know, we were talking before about high and low pressure, and that's how we get wind in the fall and in the spring are really our transitional season. So there's a lot going on in the atmosphere. You've got, you know, deeper pockets of cold air coming down from the north, which is what we're still dealing with today. You know, and so that's going to bring in a lot of wind, but it's a pretty typical thing to see. You know, we'll go through it into the fall. Winter obviously can be windy, but it's generally not as windy. And then we get back into it in the spring, and in the summer, there's generally not a whole lot of wind to deal with because everything kind of settles down and quiets down in the summertime. You know, outside of thunderstorms, obviously, but you don't generally have a whole lot of days in the summer where you've got, you know, a real windy day like we typically have it in the fall and in the spring.
Yeah, Hayden mentioned daylight savings time, and this is a topic of conversation in my house, which I invariably also mangle. Explain to me once and for all, and I'm sure this is on your website, the actual origin. There is all kinds of folk wisdom as to why it started. Why did daylight savings time start?
It actually started for the railroads.
Oh.
Back in the 30s, there's a long story to history about it, and it's really fascinating, and I don't want to mangle it either because I haven't looked at it in a while.
Yeah.
But it actually, you could go even up to, I remember writing a piece about it, and there was a fellow from Saratoga Springs in the 1880s that started to come up with this concept. And from there, it went on where it was for the railroads and to be able to help with their times of, you know, because they used to travel with mail and all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem was, as we got into the 20s, and I think it was officially made official by FDR. I could be wrong on that, but it was in the 30s, I believe. And what essentially happened before that was you had time zones that were basically just, it might be the equivalent of Dan McCoy saying, hey, I want Albany County to stay on standard time. and then having the county executive in Saratoga County say, no, I want daylight saving time. Like, that's how goofy it was.
Yeah.
There was, I think, from between a small town in West Virginia and a small town in Western Pennsylvania, where, again, you had a lot of railroad cars going because you had a lot of coal and things. You had seven different time zones in like 120 miles or something like
wow.
that. It was crazy.
Yeah.
Like back and forth. So that's when the federal government stepped in and said, okay, we're going to have set established time zones. But it's weird because, you know, when you depending on where you are in that time zone, it affects how much sunlight you get. Like in Detroit, for example, the sun comes up 40 minutes later than it does in New York City
yeah.
because it's farther west, but yet it's still in the central time zone. When I lived in Auburn, Alabama, we were just about a half hour's drive into the central time zone. So we had the benefits of that. So I, for one, wish that Congress would just get rid of it. It has, you know, it would be a congressional act. They would just basically just make it a law and keep it the same. And it would basically, people would have to decide whether they wanted, you want more sunlight in the morning, or do you want earlier in the morning, or do you want sunlight to last later in the day?
Yeah.
And it feels like when we go to standard time, we get kind of, we're kind of the short end of both sticks.
Indeed, but, we do.
You know, but anyway, it'll be interesting. I think it'll get done at some point. It's just not necessary anymore. And all the data support going to one standard time across the span of the year with respect to mental health, with respect to automobile accidents and all kinds of stuff. It just doesn't make sense anymore. So, but don't try to inject sense into government.
Sometimes. Well, that's a perfect day to make that point, Jason Goff. What's the website once again, buddy?
It is jasonsweather.com, Ray. And I have a new format for my email. So you can go on, you can sign up for my daily email, like Bluto and Animal House says, don't cost nothing. So you just sign up and you'll get an email. It'll be in your inbox at 5 o'clock every morning. I've streamlined it a little bit, made it a little more simplified, and people seem to really like it. I've gotten some great feedback and a lot of people are reading it. So check it out.
Jason Goff, thank you for being here, man. Go vote now, all right?
I've already voted, Ray, and it was not bad in the lines either, so I hope everybody can do the same.
All right, we'll talk to you soon. Support comes from Adele Shafridi Studio and Gallery, a new jewelry store in Rhinebeck, featuring studio-made fine jewelry using recycled 18-karat gold, platinum, and silver, naturally colored gemstones, and conflict-free diamonds. Shafridi.com. Interim Healthcare thanking their caregivers working to help people remain safe in their homes, serving the Capital Region, Columbia County, Glens Falls, and Saratoga. InterimHealthcare.com. Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts, quarriers and fabricators used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking. Rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires. AshfieldStone.com. And Chester Common Table, Main Street, Chester, Massachusetts, locally sourced comfort food, wine, and cocktails offering socially distant dining indoors and out Thursday through Sunday from 4 to 9 p.m. ChesterCommonTable.com. Okay, I think I lost my voice. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.